and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me and picking me up at the airport. I also have gotten the biggest kick out of the out and screwing up. I just love it. You know, I think, I don't know, they said alcoholism is hereditary, you get from your parents, but you know, insanity is hereditary, you get from your kids. And better your kids than mine. I've done my number with mine. I think it's great that they're good. I mean, what else? There are kids, huh? I come to you from Blythe, California, and surely you all know where Blythe, California is, huh? It's where God sends you when you ask for stuff, you know, and, and what I'm doing in Blythe, I'm really from Orange County, California, but what I'm doing in Blythe is a man. Huh? Well, there's nothing else that would get me to Blythe, and if he dies tomorrow, I'm out of there tomorrow night. He's such a terrific guy, though. You know, it's we're just like two strange animals that got together because we're so different. Yeah, he's a cowboy farmer, and in case you didn't know, I'm a Mexican. And I'm a barrio Mexican and a California Mexican, and that makes us a little bit different than your regular Mexican, because that makes us a little stranger than most people, most Mexicans anyway. And he is just about the greatest guy that I've ever known. He's the first toad I ever kissed that turned into a prince. Yes. Usually I kiss them as princes and turn them into toads. I don't know. I do magic on them. I also think I have Al-Anonism of the Vinoy variety, whatever that is, except that as I talk, you'll know what I'm talking about. For those of you that were lucky enough to be in there this afternoon, I'm telling you, this guy, I've got him convinced he never had it so good. And he loves me so much that he knows that that I just hate to work anymore, that he tells me if he feels that he's going to go, that he's going to run to the freeway and eat a truck so I can get double indemnity on his insurance. We're both dedicated to making me happy, huh? He thinks a woman's place is in the mall. That's what I'm doing in Blythe. I'm really, really very grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm just really grateful to know that's what's wrong with me. I just always knew I was strange. I was born into a family that wasn't ready for me then and isn't ready for me now. You know, they still don't think I'm an alcoholic. They just think I'm just weird and strange and... I was born into this family a long time ago. I'm really a young person in an old container. And I was born a long time ago, and they kept the mothers in the hospital a whole week. And when they came home with this baby, they didn't have a name for me. And the reason for that is because my daddy wanted to name me after his girlfriend, and my mother's narrow-minded. I mean, my mother is of a little purple lip variety, not blue lips because she's a Mexican, so they get purple. And I had an older sister that was perfect. You know the type I'm talking about. They always told her what to do, and she always did it. And she always did it right, and she screwed it up for me. And because I never knew how to be good. I never remembered to be good until after I was bad. And it was too late, and they're always whipping on me. I don't know I'm a better child. If I'd have known I was a better child, I'd have held it against them guys. I just thought that's the price you pay for not knowing how to be good. And no matter what I tried, it just seemed that it always eluded me. They were divorced when I was 7, and my mother would say things to me like, "You're just like your father." And I knew what her opinion was of him. She didn't like him too well. So she'd send me to the nuns so they could teach me to be a lady. And what the nun thought was the lady was really boring to me. It was not appealing to me then, and it isn't appealing to me now. Because not only did I not know how to be good, but as soon as they said, "Thou shalt not," I may not have thought of doing it before, but as soon as they said, "Thou shalt not," I had an overwhelming desire to do it. And it... And it would... And it would get in my head and I just couldn't seem to get rid of it. I couldn't think of anything else until I did it. And then I'd have to relax and then I'd go home and get my whipping. So somebody dared me and I raised the nun's skirt to see what she wore under all them clothes because we were all wondering what it was and I couldn't stand it. And I don't remember too much because, you know, you pull them up and run. And something like combat boots or... So then if I'm a little barrio, right, I'm an embarrassment to my mother. I'm always an embarrassment to my mother. So I got my whipping. And the next day that I got to school, all the kids thought I was terrific. It seems to me that I was born with an emptiness in my soul, a yearning, a hunger, a longing to be loved, to be wanted, to be accepted. I know as a child I used to worship my mother. I ached and hungered for my mother's love and approval. And it seemed that no matter what I did, I was never enough. There was always something wrong with me. It seems I was always so hungry to be loved that I would give my heart to anybody that would take it. You see, I always felt that love could fix me and that no, I was something very, very unlovable about me that didn't seem to be wrong with other people. So when I got all that attention, it filled up some of them empty places. The overruling emotion on my life, as far back as I can remember, and for a long time into sobriety, is this terrible feeling inside of emptiness, of hugging myself and rocking myself and wailing like a wounded animal, you see. I don't know that it's called loneliness. I just know that it was with me constantly, and I was baffled by life. It was shortly after that. I believe that I'm one of those that always had the pilot lit. All I ever needed was the fuel. And I started, I don't know what you do as a child, what you did as a child when you already had this something inside. I used to read all the fairy tale books and go home and just fantasize about that knight in shining armor, that prince, it's always a prince, right? That's going to rescue and discover me or whatever. I mean, I'm just a child, but I'm always thinking men. And of course, at that time, it was like my daddy. My daddy was just, I mean, I don't blame him for leaving her. Yeah, it was all her fault. So I used to think I knew if I could only get to my daddy, everything going to be all right. Now, when I was 12 years old, things were happening in our home. I was being molested by my stepfather, and I told my mother, and she said I was a liar. But it was not so. And today I know she could not possibly face that. And my motive for telling her was to get her. I always wanted to get her, you know, to punish her because she couldn't give me that love that I thought that would take care of the emptiness inside of me. I felt so abandoned, always felt abandoned. I didn't know that's the name of it. I just felt alone. I ran off to be with my daddy when I was 12 years old because I knew it was going to be better over there. Now, my daddy was over in the San Fernando Valley, which is about 60 miles from where I was, where he'd taken up light housekeeping with a lady with 8 kids. And all he wants is one more, right? So here comes trouble. And he used to take people up north to pick grapes and prunes. And, you know, God made two kinds of Mexicans. That's fruit pickers and non-fruit pickers. And I'm not a fruit picker. They tried to make a fruit picker out of me, and it didn't take. Now, I've gotten close to many strange things, but work ain't one of them. But we stayed beyond the season with the Gallo brothers, and they gave my dad a case of sherry wine. And somebody must have said, "Thou shalt not." I had a big water glass of that sherry wine, and when it went down with a boom. I mean, I didn't just feel a part of it. I just felt tingly all over. Huh? It's just too bad something that good has to be wasted on social drinkers that don't appreciate it. I appreciated it. Anything gonna make me feel that good, I want more. And then it's the next day. I don't know what happened. I come to. Now I'm from the Pachuco days. You know, it's a long time ago. We used to wear them big hairdos. You come to after you've thrown up all over yourself, you know. God. Clothes are torn. And I know something. I did something terrible. I don't know what it was, but I knew it was terrible, whatever it was. And it seemed to me that I started a lifetime of looking at people's faces, trying to figure out what I had done. Terrified to know and terrified not to know. I also had a sense of shame of being dirty inside of me. And I don't know what to do with those feelings. I don't even know what they are. I just know that it made me feel worse than I had ever done. And it seemed like it was a lifetime of secrets. I could not share how I felt with anybody. I didn't know you could. I just covered it up like I always did, either with violence or as a clown. Like I didn't care. I always pretended like I didn't care, but inside my soul shriveled up. One more time. It wasn't long after that I went back to my mother's because I wasn't wanted over at my dad's either. And I started thinking, that's my mother, and I'm going to go over there, and everything's going to be all right again. Now, when I got there, my mother said I couldn't come home. She and my stepfather didn't want me home. They'd been free of me over a year, and I was incorrigible, and they couldn't stand me. And I said, I don't care. I don't give a damn. But you know, inside, I had a knot the size of my fist on my throat where I wanted them to put for her to put her arm around me and tell me that she loved me. And I couldn't ask for that which I needed. I just said, I don't care. You know how those of us like me do. And I went out and I lived here and there and everywhere with anybody that would take me in for a little while. And everybody would take me in for a little while because they felt sorry for me. But you know, once I started my drinking, there was no stopping me. I just drank at every chance that I could. And I'm young and I'm cute and I'm a clown and hang around with older people, so I got drunk pretty regularly. First of all, we Mexicans, we like to have them parties whole weekends. You know, we get drunk several times, and in our parties, the cops came several times. If you don't have a knifing and a shooting or several of them big fights, you ain't had a good time. You know, you just start. Don't laugh, you guys. Yeah, I know you know what I'm talking about. I also don't know how to work, so I take up burglary. I wasn't a bad person, just seemed to be like a good idea at the time. And I'm one of those original topless, bottomless dancers in them parties in Orange County. I don't even get paid for it. I don't even remember it. But you know, the girls always want to tell you what you did the next day, so I used to beat them up, and then they didn't tell me, because violence is the way I handled anything that was embarrassing or uncomfortable. So I went about my business burglarizing people's houses, and if anybody lived here in Orange County in the late 40s or early 50s, I'd like to make my amends tonight. I really wasn't a bad person. Your things were just much more interesting than mine. And I really was surprised when the state of California discovered me. They didn't understand whether my case was different. They took me before a judge, and there sat my mother and all them other purple-lipped relatives. And I'm sitting over here, and I've got my shirt. You know, in those days, we had a collar up. That was what was cool. Slouched down in your seat. And the judge asked me, well, young lady, what do you think we ought to do with you? And I said, well, man, you're the judge. You ought to know. And so I slouched down my chair, and that was the wrong person to have that kind of an attitude with, because he sent me up to do a little bit of time for the state of California. And I went to a Ventura school for girls, and I was sent up for 9 months. And I got out 13 months later, because I don't know how to be good there either. I'm really a walking bust. Everything I ever did, I always got caught in. And it pissed me off everybody else talking about getting away with stuff. When they let me out, I took my very first inventory. Yeah, I thought I would be the only gray-haired little old lady in that girls' reformatory. But when they finally let me out, I took my first inventory. I'm always wanting to live in the answer instead of the problem. So I said, I don't have a job. I don't have a money. I don't have any education. I don't have a home. And I'm thinking, what an order. I can't go through with it. I better go out find me a husband. Because God knows I need somebody to take care of me. I knew I couldn't take care of myself. So So I went out looking for a husband in places that husbands are not to be looked for. And unfortunately for both of us, I found one. Yeah? I've been apologizing to my kids ever since for the bad genes we put together. But, you know, there was a certain kind of man that always caught my attention. Usually they got big muscles, don't they? And they wear them real tight t-shirts, you know, and they got tattoos on their arms. And mother, born to lose. And they walk with a little slouch and they have their hair all slicked back, get a shiny hair, shiny eyes, and all teeth. And they look at you and say, what's happening, baby? Oh, God, that still gives me goosebumps. You know what I'm talking about. I used to think that look was charisma. Today I know it to be psychosis. My sponsor tells me you can't make chicken salad out of chicken shit, but we tried. He was a mainline heroin user, and you just don't live happily ever after with one of those. Very exciting, but not very happy. But of course, you know, you're going to change for me. So we got, 3 months later, we were pregnant, and I was married in that order. He decides I'm supposed to stay home. He starts hearing all them stories about me and them bars, and he don't want people talking about his wife that way, so he decides I should stay home. After all, I'm pregnant. And I'm all right. I want to be a good Mexican wife, too. He had an idea for what a good Mexican wife should be, and I had an idea for what a good Mexican husband should be, and never the twain shall meet. And we both got scars to prove it, because I'm not very timid. And he don't want me to drink except when I'm with him, and I'm all right with that. You know, I want to be a good Mexican wife, too. But he don't want to stay home, so I tell him, I give him some handy hints on how to live his life. And when he doesn't do it, I tell him a few things about his mother and his ancestry and so on. And so, he don't want me talking that way about his family, so he tells me he's going to hit me. And so I have to jump him. I mean, that's like saying, thou shalt not. So we either had a honeymoon or a battle in our home. And he introduces me to little white pills with crosses on them. I don't know what they are, but I sure knew what they did to me. I had one eyeball over there and one over there, and I'd make baby clothes all night long. The same one, tearing apart, putting it together. I don't know whether I'm putting it together or tearing it apart, so I'm always doing one or the other. And you know, you can take that junk, smoke cigarettes, drink coffee, chew gum, clean your house with a toothbrush, sing the songs with a mariachi band, whether you want to or not, 3 days and 3 nights later, you're still doing it. And he says, Jesus Christ, if I could only stop, my body said, stop it, but my mind says, yeah, let's do it. You know, and, I don't need nobody else. He can scrape me off the ceiling, you know. Every so often he'd walk in, a little bit. But then the battle was on. It was just really an exciting time in my life. Now, for 12 solid years, I was not to know what it was to have a sober day. And it promised me so much. Any moment when I took that poison inside of me, any moment it was going to get better and stay better. And it promised me all the excitement and thrills, and that's what I was addicted to also. And all it delivered was hell, because one day at a time I went into literal hell, and that's not what I really wanted. Deep down inside of me, I just wanted somebody to love me. I just wanted to have some little house in some corner of some barrio with a tortilla smells and enchilada smells, and he comes home at 5 o'clock, and there I am with the slippers and the kitties. You're kind of a Mexican Aussie and Harriet type of a the dolphin, and I'll tell you what, it was something. By the time I had my baby, I knew I have had lots of bottoms in this in my drinking. By the time I had my baby, I realized this man didn't want to be married, and I figured out he didn't want to be married to me, because he found out that thing about me that everybody knew except me. I don't know what it is. And so when they put that baby in my arms, I felt like finally, somebody belongs to me. That baby belonged to me. That baby inspired feelings within me that nobody ever has before or since. I worship my baby. And I would sit by the hour and look at my baby, and I love my baby. I promised my baby I would never mistreat her, abandon her, and discard her as I had been. And I meant it with every fiber of my being. If I could have been any different, I would have done it for my baby. But I'm an alcoholic and I am a woman alcoholic. And when I drink, I have absolutely no choices and no rights. When I drink, I'm going to do what's in front of me to do because it's there to do. I never think about prices. I never think about what's going to happen tomorrow if I do this. It just seems like it's a good idea at the time. And I'm always baffled when the price comes in, you see. And I took that baby and her sister to places that children should not be taken because I am an alcoholic. Deep down inside of me, there was always a spark that I never could quite kill of the woman that I am tonight. I thought there was a monster that lived within me. I don't know how to live like them other people seem to live, a successful life. After the second one was born, I left her daddy because I was old. I was 22 years old, and I felt older than I do today at 58, you see. And I went out, and I thought, I'd better find me another husband. I already had one sort of picked out. And so I kicked this one out, and I fell in love. And when I fall in love, I fall in love all over my body. Every inch of me falls in love forever. I can't remember the names of some of the men I've fallen in love with forever. The faces change. It's the feelings that stay the same. This time it's going to be different. It's him. You know that him? The prince that I kiss him and they turn into toads. I don't know. I do magic on them. This guy's name was Danny, but his nickname was CB, and it stood for crazy bastard. And he was my after-hours boyfriend. CB and I would ride around his motorcycle. He had a motorcycle about the time they had the wild one and stuff like that. And we'd cruise around the orchards of Orange County without any lights on, make love under the orange groves. It was really romantic. Hard on your back with them dirt clods, but it was really romantic. Many a time I had to come home where there was not enough chemicals to kill what I had. When I would walk into that cold water shack and turn the lights on, and the sink would be black with cockroaches, and there would be mice in the filthy floor, and in that shack lived two little girls that the romance of being a mother had long since died, and the responsibility for them choked me. And I didn't know what to do with these two little girls. There was no place I could take them. Nobody wanted them. My mother-in-law had raised nothing but addicts. And my mother was living with my stepfather, who was a child molester, and I didn't know what to do with these little girls. You see, and secretly, they just, their responsibility for them irritated me, and I became a monster. I didn't come here by myself. There's an ugly side of my disease, and that is the part that my children played in it. You see, they were little girls that didn't know how to argue above a whisper. They were little girls that never watched television with sound on. And when they would have little arguments, they would whisper their arguments. They were terrified of the monster, because if I would come to before I was ready, sometimes the modeling guilt, and I'd hug them and cry and take them and buy them and do all those things that the self-pity guilt would force me to do. Or other times, the monster would come to in a rage, and I would start screaming and yelling, and then I would start hitting. And once I started hitting, it was like watching somebody else, and I'd hit and I'd hit and I'd hit until there was blood and screams and gore and prayers and beggings, and I couldn't stop, and I wouldn't stop. And I think to myself at that time, I'd scream inside of me, for God's sake, stop, stop. And I couldn't stop. I don't know what's wrong with me. I just think that there is a monster that lives within me. I've heard many women come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and say that they've taken away their children, and you cry and you're very sad, and I understand. But in those days, I used to think, for God's sake, won't somebody please take these little girls and give them a normal life, because I can't. I don't know that I have something as simple as alcoholism. I just know I'm a monster and deserve to die. That's what I thought. And so when you live with this kind of an inside, I had to run and I had to drink and I had to do what I had to do to get away from me. I spent 5 years as an unprotected by drinking woman in those years. I know the feeling of degradation and self-loathing that a woman alcoholic goes through when she's a bar drinker and she's not protected, you see. I know the secrets. I know the feeling of filth and dirt that's inside, you see. The healing has been incredible. But it didn't take, it took me a long time after that. After 5 years, I started getting letters from a husband that was someplace in Texas, in Fort Worth, Texas, getting the cure, and he sends letters home. And babe, this time it's going to be different. You know, I'm clutching at straws. He sends them pictures, and there's nobody like a dope fiend that can clean up good. Man, he lifts weights and he's good in that hospital, and he sends this. He looks good. Yeah, and so we again, he built them castles in the air, and again, I lived in them. And we made the Mexican geographic. We moved about 20 miles from Mama. Never could stand Mama, but never could go too far away. I was always afraid if I moved too far away and come back, they wouldn't know who I was. You see, that's how important I thought I was in anybody's life. And we did what all people, I guess, in our situation do, is change the environment. We moved away and we bought a little ranch with an acre for us was a ranch. There were the chickens and the turkeys and the horses, and we were going to be farmers, this Dolphin and I. I even married him in the Catholic Church, and that's going to any length for a Catholic. Especially since he was a Methodist, but I was going to make this work with this guy whether he wanted it or not. We were going to stay together forever. And we joined the PTA. And that first Christmas, this Dolphin gangster was Santa Claus. If them folks had only known on who's left the little darlings were sitting on. Well, I'm a firm believer you can place me in the best of circumstances, and sooner or later I have to create whatever is inside of me. Because it's inside of me that I can't live, you see. When he starts making a pass at my neighbor, I go beat her up. I don't know, if you're like normal people, you can't beat up the neighbors, but I go hold my mud and kick her butt. He starts making the run to Orange County to his connection, and the best thing I can say about Mira Loma is the name of this place. It's in the middle of four wineries, and it's right by, I don't know if you ever heard of Cucamonga, but it's a wine country south, and I think some of the wine I was drinking never saw the grape. You know, But this is the time when my drinking changed. I thought it was because I had a hysterectomy, my drinking changed. Where before I had drank in the bars and had the booze and the boys and the cha-cha-cha. Now I just want to drink by myself behind closed doors and the windows drawn and in my bedroom. This is the time when I want to drink and I drink and I drink and my body's drunk and my mind's in agony. And the only time I get out of the house is to make the run to those wineries where I would buy 4 gallons of wine and come home and go back to bed. And Mommy's always sick. And I would go through this time and time and time, over and over and over again until I got so weary. I get come to the place in my drinking where I drank and I drank and I drank and my body was drunk and my mind was in agony. No matter how much poison I put inside of me, I could not kill the madness inside. I got so tired and I started looking for answers. And when I look for answers, I look for answers in the way I guess a lot of people do. I started reading the Bible and I started going to churches. And I mean churches. I've been to churches where they sprinkle you, where they dunk you, where they throw flowers at you, where they tell you who wants to be saved, go down the aisle. I was always the first one to get down the aisle to get saved before anybody else did, because I know I had to be first just to be even. So I always got saved, and it felt so good, and I walk out the door, get home, get unsaved. I don't know. When you do this over and over again, I got so weary and so tired. I just wanted to die. And I started planning to die. And you know, that was the only time I ever had any kind of peace for the longest time when I made a decision to die. And what I did is I saved my sleeping pills. And I waited until this man was home because I couldn't bring myself to kill myself and have those little girls find me. So I waited until he was home and he was sitting there watching television and nodding out probably. And I said, I'm going to kill myself. And he said, all right, and went back to watching television. We had a slight communication problem by this time. So I went and took a bath. You know, I ain't having very many baths by this time. But I went and took a bath and washed the clothes and put on clean pajamas, you know, just in case I died, they wouldn't know how I lived. You know how you do it? Make all that scenery out so they'd all be sorry. But I was not kidding. I was not doing it for attention. I was just weary. And I went to my bedroom to die, and I came to a couple of days later, and I wasn't glad to be alive. I was enraged to be alive. This man had been in my bed both nights, and never once did he consider taking me to a doctor, to a hospital. And I guess deep down inside, I always thought, that's all right. If nobody loves me, at least he does. And this was a convincer that even he wanted me dead. And so what I came to on what has got to be the loneliest day of my life, where I couldn't drink, and I couldn't be sober, and I couldn't live, and I couldn't die, and there was nothing to kill the madness inside of me. I know today that my higher power has always had his hand upon my life, even upon that day. Because that very day, there's a knock on the door, there's a lady from the PTA. If there's somebody I didn't want to see, the lady from the PTA. There stands Mrs. Clean. Hi. Now I'm a barrio Mexican, and you know you hang around with each other. You don't hang around with no Anglos. And she's from them dairy people that get all dressed up just to stay at home and somebody else cleans their house. Mine had been cleaned sort of when I was going to die, and I'd been in that bed for 2 days, and sometimes I made it to the bathroom and sometimes I didn't. So, I'm running a weakness. I let her in and I tell her my tale of woe because she knows something's wrong. And she stays with me and she cleans me up. And somehow throughout the conversation when she asked me what's wrong, I told her about this SOB and how he'd done me wrong. I didn't tell her anything about me. I never told anybody anything about me. Yeah, I hid who I was from anybody. But she stayed with me and cleaned me up and asked me if I ever heard of Al-Anon. And I never heard of Al-Anon. But I got the idea that if I went there, he would straighten up. So this lady took me to Al-Anon, and I walked into this room. That room, I felt a little bit like a whore would in a nunnery. There was absolutely no identification between me and them square bras. But, you know, they hugged me, and I smiled at them. Someplace along the line in my life, I had been told I had a beautiful smile. I don't know whether I did or not, but I gave them my beautiful smile. You know, that one that goes, the lights are on, but there's nobody home, you know? I thought I was fooling them. I found out about later they used to laugh at me. I thought I was fooling them. And I don't hear nothing. And every so often this lady takes me back, and I don't even want to go, but I don't know how to tell her I don't want to go. I just go and smile at them. I don't hear anything. One day I heard something called release, so I went home. In the meantime, I had been thinking, taking another inventory, how I'm going to get rid of him. Now I couldn't divorce him. I married him in the Catholic Church. But I used to contemplate justifiable homicide. If anybody deserved to die, he did. It would have been a mercy killing. So when I heard the word release, I went home and told him in detail how I was going to release him. I wish I'd have thought about cutting up a chicken. Oh, I think that's absolutely marvelous. I just told him I was going to pour out wax in his eyes and in his ears. And he used to sleep with his clothes on in the front room and a knife under the pillow. And I'd sit in a corner with a big black coat on and watch him. As he'd be a dozy enough, I'd go take a little peek at him and he'd go, oh, God, that sounds so good. It was almost sexual. You know, it's just, oh, so and he would say unkind things to me. He'd say, baby, I may have a monkey on my back, but you got an orangutan. And I thought, how dare he? I thought he was so bad, he made me look good. And one day, he knew who the crazy one was, because one day I came home and he was gone. He took everything with him. He wasn't planning on coming back. And he was of the type that always left something behind so he could come claim it when I cooled down a little bit and let him back in the door. This time he was gone. And that's the way it had to be. Because though that life was unbearable, it was familiar. And fear has been the great compromiser of my life. I'd have stayed there forever until I killed him or forced him to kill me. Because sometimes the madness would be so unbearable that the only thing that would relieve it would be physical violence. And I would force him to hit me. When he'd say, don't talk to me or my mother or my whack of dad, what animal, I'll hit you. And you know, don't tell me that. I'd always jump in first. I always lost every battle, but I always had the satisfaction of jumping in first. And when he'd say, stay down so I don't keep hitting you, I'd get up one more time, and I'd look like a monster. And after that was over, I'd go around to the neighbors and my mother-in-law and say, look what your son did to me. Huh? That poor guy. He's still alive, a miracle of miracles. But we were like two strange animals trying to get along. And after that, he left. The Al-Anons got together and threw me out of Al-Anon. And that same lady took me to my first AA meeting, and I knew them Al-Anons had gotten together and threw me over to their husbands, who they didn't like either. And they took me to this, I'm from Mira Loma at the time, and they took me to a young people's meeting on a Friday night in Pomona. And they took me to this old house, and she brought me to the back. Well, I'm a Mexican, that's why they're bringing me through the back door. And so they took me through the kitchen where all them Al-Anons are standing there doing whatever Al-Anons do in the kitchen. And I am looking in their eyes. I am not about to look at the contempt in their eyes. I just look at my feet and walk through them. I walked into the young people's meeting in August of 1964 and listened to the sounds of Alcoholics Anonymous. The very first thing that attracted me to you was the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know the words, but I hear the music of one drunk talking to another. I know about listening to that belly laughter, that smile that reaches the soul, that shine in the eyes, and that happy talk. And those are the sounds and the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just sat back there, and I hungered for it, and I wanted it. I just said, it's too bad I'm not an alcoholic. If there's another name for the disease that you and I have, it's called I Ain't Got It. I knew it was much more so acceptable to me to be strange and different and 3 steps ahead of the man with a butterfly nest. But I used to be not an alcoholic because, you see, alcohol had been an answer for me. All that poison had been an answer for me. I just hadn't found the right combination again, you see. I often wondered what happens in this room when you and I come together. And it came to me one day, and I considered a spiritual experience when I realized that these are just empty rooms. That which happens in here, we bring it with us, every one of us. And it intermingles and becomes a group conscience, the higher power. You call it whatever you want. But there's a dynamic something that happens when you and I come together. And newcomer, if you be lucky like me, I just let it wash over my soul, and I hungered for it. I wanted it so bad. But because I wasn't an alcoholic, I looked around at all them sober, single, good-looking young guys, and I said, man, I'm going to get me one of those. And I did. It was the sickest one there. It had to be, because I got radar. I'm one that believes that it takes what it takes, and that's what it took for me, you see. And for 10 months, I came around Alcoholics Anonymous as a visitor. In Pomona, in the days that I got sober, they used to go around the room and everybody gave their name. When it came to me, I'd say, I'm Angie and I'm a visitor. I didn't say I was an Al-Anon. They kicked me out of Al-Anon, and I'm certainly not an alcoholic. If I was an alcoholic, it was something a little bit like potential. You know, I started identifying. Now, someplace along the line, I stopped drinking and doubled up on the Miltowns and Benzedrine and got weirder. And then this guy wants to get rid of me. They always want to get rid of me because I want to kill them. And the only reason I want to kill them is because they don't behave. If they did right how they're supposed to do, I wouldn't be mad at them and want to kill them. And this guy wasn't doing right, so I try to kill him. And when they're sober, they want to get rid of you. Well, I'm not easy to get rid of because I didn't have a backup. So I moved to Pomona to be closer to the action. And there were, one day I walked into a room and then this cute little boy talking. He had big blue eyes and blonde hair. I have an affinity for blue eyes and blonde hair. It's now blue eyes and gray hair because time she do the march on. But this little guy had just gotten out of a reformatory. And he's talking. He says he don't have a girlfriend, he don't have a surfboard, and he don't have a car. And I'm thinking to myself, come here, little boy, I'll take care of you. And I did. And he don't know what hit him. He thought a Mack truck hit him. But we all have our purpose. After that relationship was over, he decided to become a minister. And I'd like to think that somehow, in my small way, I helped push him over to God. Now, I don't like women, and I don't trust men. And that don't leave you much. And I never heard anything about withdrawals. All I heard is you keep coming back and live happily ever after. That's all I ever heard. You didn't talk or I didn't hear anything about walking them streets without any skin on, about having Charlie horses and your thighs so bad you can only scream. Well, you can't walk and you can't talk and you can't sit and you can't sleep and you can't think. And you can't decide whether you're going to kill yourself or somebody else or be happy. Yeah, it's like the emotions were jumping up and down and sideways and all over. And I don't know about everybody's talking about you and don't like you and hearing voices, having blackouts without drinking. I didn't know about that. I didn't know about walking them. The only time there was ever any relief is when I would go to a meeting. And for that hour and a half, it seemed that madness would be alleviated. The only time was when I was hanging around with you guys. I loved hanging around with you guys from the beginning. I used to walk them streets till all hours of the night. And he was the one that walked them streets with me. He was the first man that had ever been kind to me. He was the first man that had ever been gentle with me. And everywhere that he went, he wanted to take me with him. And he always seemed so proud to be seen with me. Me that had always been abused by every man I'd ever had. I hungered for it. I know today that you and I do not come together. I truly believe that we come together by divine appointment. And yet every relationship is its beginning and its parting. Every relationship. When that appointment has been met and you go on your way, you leave a little bit of you behind and you take a little bit of me with you. And we're never the same because our lives have touched. And I don't know that, Dad. You see, I was always so hungry for love that I clutched with a death grip. And I would have kept him forever if I could have, you see, because I was clutched. I turned my will and my life over to his care because I didn't believe that God cared enough about me. I believed in God. I just didn't think that he cared about me. So I turned my will and my life over to this man. And when he got drunk, so did I. It was not my worst drunk, but it just seemed to be my most hopeless one. The madness came back. I didn't even know it was gone. And I drink and I drink and I drink again and my body's drunk and my mind's in agony and I just want to die. I try to hang myself with a plastic bag over my head. And my children ran over and threw their arms around my knees and said, Mommy, Mommy, please don't kill yourself. And Jesus Christ, the guilt for them kids has saved my life again. And I came back to you because a man named Carson brought me back on a rainy Wednesday night in December. And the miracle for me is not that I've come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, because hundreds and hundreds of people come and don't stay. The miracle for me is that I'm still here. And that last December, the 22nd, I celebrated my 26th birthday. And that is the miracle. And the victory is not mine. Yes, 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 yes. My sobriety and my victory is not mine. It belongs to us, you see. I am a product today of so many people that have come to teach me and have come to learn from me too. It helps to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, back to Alcoholics Anonymous, desperate. You see, that's what helped me. I had no choice. I had no place else to turn to. See, I couldn't kill myself or I would have. Deep down inside of me, I always had that as a secret. If this program didn't work for me, I'd just find a way to kill myself because I couldn't stand to that war anymore. I came back, but before I thought I was a little alcoholic, now I thought I was too alcoholic. I have had trouble with that in-between place. And they read something in my area all wrong for people like me. First of all, they read, rarely have we seen a person fail. And I knew when they said rarely, somebody wasn't going to make it. And then they say, they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. I said, man, I'm screwed. I knew I was born that way. My mother will tell you I was born that way. And who would know better than one's mother? But a little further on down it says, and then there are those that have grave emotional and mental disorders. I am so grateful they have that in there. Because that's the catch-all for those of us that think my case is different. And you know, the longer I'm in AA, the longer I see people coming in, the harder it is to say my case is different. And if you're an alcoholic from my area, you got to have a lot of andas. Am I alcoholic? Anda. And you say, isn't it strange how we just got to be different? What a relief it is when it says, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and that covers every aberration that may happen to cross my mind. Every aberration that happens to cross my mind. But you see, a little further on down it says, many of them do recovery. They have the capacity, to be honest. And the most honest I can get is to stand up here and tell you, I'm an alcoholic. That's it. Nothing more and nothing less. I'm an alcoholic. You know, you don't have to be well to stay sober. All you have to drink is you don't drink and you don't die. You get to be an old timer. And you just try a lot of things that don't work to find out the ones that do. And I tell you that they say many of them do recovery. They have the capacity. Do you want to be honest? I'm not presumptuous to stand up here and tell you that I have the capacity to be honest. I don't even know the difference between right and wrong. It may seem strange to you, but if I think I'm doing something and I want to do it bad enough, I can go home and pray about it and meditate about it and pray about it and meditate about it. And sooner or later, God will whisper in my ear that it's His will for me. Once I tell me that story, it had nothing to come and tell you I've had a spiritual experience. You know? Thank God. God sends people that ruin this kind of thinking for us. They're called sponsors. I have a sponsor who is a fascist sponsor. She's of the fascist variety, and she gets a warped satisfaction of being unkind to me. And I like Renoy, when I grow up, I want to be like my sponsor. Because you see, she tells me things that make me keep coming back. And when I tell that to the people that I sponsor, they never talk to me again. She says things to me like, you know, when you want to do something, you just can't hardly wait to do it. And God gave you that message that it's for you. And she says, Angie, you don't have to sit in your own shit just because it's warm. Or sure, if that doesn't catch my attention, she'll say, well, I don't know about you. Maybe you need to eat shit with a rusty spoon one more time. God, I used to take ashtrays. I don't smoke very much. I cut down from half a pack down to one cigarette a night. But I used to take ashtrays when I'd go speak in conferences as a souvenir. And she found out about it and said, I was stealing. And I said, I'm not stealing them. They're just souvenirs. And she couldn't convince me that it was not stealing. And one day she said to me, Angie, I don't know about you, but my integrity sure worth more than an ashtray. Oh, she ruined it for me. You know, I never took another ashtray after that. I've gotten several as gifts, and I take them home. But somebody else steal them. I didn't steal them. You know, in the beginning, it was a step up to be called an alcoholic from some of the things I've been called. And in the beginning, they all know more than me. Then I know more than some of them. Now, I don't like women anymore just because I'm sober. I don't like women that got lots of time because they look at me. I don't know what they're seeing, but whatever they're seeing, I don't want them to see. So I stay away from the women that got a lot of time, and I don't like them young women, because I got this young guy with me still, you know, the one, and I'm like a monkey with its monklet. You know, I'm trying to keep everybody away from my monklet. So I go and check out them young girls, and I say, let's go this way, honey. But the guys are always much more friendlier, aren't they? Whether they're new or got lots of time, they always like to pat you on the head and on the ass or have a little accidents around the boobs. You know, I guess... Now that it's become fashionable to be... sexual harassment. I think I'll do some of that retroactive stuff. Anyway... I loved how I felt with you guys, and you told me I got to go to a meeting every night, so I go to a meeting every night. And I start learning stuff. I'm reading. I'm finally able to read a paragraph and find out what it says. In the beginning, you know, you read stuff, it just bounce off. You know, I don't know what I'm reading. I can read the same paragraph all day long and still don't have nothing going in there. Finally, something starts going in there, and I want to be able to talk. And the Pomona used to go around the room, and I always think all this neat stuff I'm going to tell you. Then it stopped in this guy. You know, in the beginning, I like everybody, then I hate one. I don't know if anybody's here that crass to hate a member of Alcoholics. No. I don't know anything except love and hate. I have like a measuring stick with numbers from 0 to 100, with no numbers in between. And I hated this guy. I hated the way he walked, the way he talked, the way he smoked, the way he breathed, everything about it. And I knew that because I had watched him diligently. And like, you just love to hate this kind of people. Don't you just do it? And he'd, when they go around the table, it always, I don't care what side they start, always stop with him. He'd go, he talks so slow, kind of, I'd be foaming at the mouth. And I hear you say things like, resentments are the number one offender for the alcoholic, they're fatal. But they used to scare me, because I don't want to drink no more, you see, you guys. So I just try to do what you tell me to do, collectively, not singular, but collectively. And I got this thing, and I go to some of you old-timer guys that look like you know what you're talking about, put my smile on my face, and I ask, how do you get over resentments? Hey, you say turn it over easy, does it this two shall pass one day after I'm going with the book, you're coming back and don't drink. So I'm a good follower, I go home and do it, and I come back the next night and check it out, see if it works, and then work. So I think I'm going to go somebody else. I didn't want you to know I was a dummy. I didn't want to do it. You find out I was a fraud and would kick me out of here. I didn't know you couldn't kick me out of here. I was always scared you'd kick me out. So I go to somebody else, and again, I say, how do you get over resentment? And again, they say, turn it over easy, does it this too shall pass one day at a time, go home, read the book, you're coming back, and don't drink. After a while, I got the message. You don't know the answer either. You know? I just keep doing it because I don't want you to find out I'm a fraud and kick me out. One day, the guy, he always starts at tuning out. You know, we're good at tuning people out. I just so busy hating. And one day, he starts crying, and I'm thinking, he's crying. How embarrassing, he's crying. Hasn't he ever heard of John Wayne, Iwo Jima, Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata, somebody? Jesus, he only sissies and women cry. After the meeting, they all went and put their arm around him. I said, Jesus Christ, you know, I didn't want you to know I'm the only dog among you. I'd hear things like, nobody could ever hate me, or I could ever hate anybody enough to want him to drink. I wanted that guy to drink, you know. So you all went and put your arms around him, and I did too. I went and gave one of them stiff arm. I said, you know why I'm stiff? I was afraid what he had was contaminating. You know, he ain't got no class. He just comes right in and hugs me anyway, as if he wasn't going to accept the rejection. He just came right in, put his arm on my shoulder, and starts to cry. And I'm startled, you see. Something happened to me. And I stayed here long enough to have the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous happen to me. Something happened when he cried next to my person. The pain in me reached out and touched the pain in him. Because certainly I had known pain. And I had the first compassionate feeling that I had for another human being. You see, I was always a taker. Do for me, feel for me, think about me, take care of me. It never occurred to me to do anything bad for another person. And it was a miracle for me. All that resentment, all the anger, every negative feeling that I had melted away as if it had never been. And I was the beginning of my belonging in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I belong here. You see, I've been sober 9 months, and I realized that I was staying sober, and I belonged here. Now, it was just the beginning for me, really. I had several forks in the road, and that was one of the big ones for me. I married that young guy, and I still don't have a sponsor. I had one that volunteered, and she said I had to stay home and learn to be a mother, or that I had to give up that young man, or one day he would give me up. There was such a big age difference. There was 11 years difference in our ages. And I thought about it, and I didn't know how to be a mother anymore sober than I did when I was drinking. My kids couldn't stand me. They were terrified of me, even if I was sober, because they couldn't figure out whether I was going to be violent or be modeling again, because I didn't have any control over my emotions. I had a big emotional change, and I went into deep depressions for the first 7 years of my sobriety. And they were teenagers, and I thought I had distorted them beyond repair. They acted just like regular teens, I guess. Oh, I love it. And I didn't know how to live without a man. I'm not talking about sex. I'm talking about somebody that I was important to, that made the lonely, horrible something go away, at least for a little while, you see. And so I did the most reasonable thing for me, is I gave up the sponsor. She made me feel guilty. And so the group became my sponsor and my head and the sweet young thing. And with that kind of an attitude, it doesn't get much better. I got as well as I could, and I used to beat myself up for that. But I know that today they tell us to work these steps and this program to the best of my ability. And that was the best of my ability, because I'm still here. The only thing that I had, the grace of God, that never left me, was how I felt when I was with you guys. For that little while, my eyeballs were turned around to you instead of into me. When I was sober about 5.5 years, my children started drinking and taking drugs. They were into the 60s generation thing, that LSDs and all this kind of stuff. And I came home one day, we had a terrible fight. I hit them, and they hit me, and they ran off. I had one run off to Ohio. I hated my mother, only went to Mira Loma. I didn't even know any Mexicans ran off to Ohio. And I had another one that went to live in a commune and came home one day with a bin the size of a silver dollar in her chest, where people had been putting cigarettes out on. And I died inside, because all I ever wanted to do is be a good mother and to have a husband that loved me and have a home. And it was all there, and it wasn't it either. I went into a terrible depression. Had a nervous breakdown again. I contemplated an attempted suicide. The young man went and took me to the psycho ward, went home, packed his clothes, and left me. And I felt betrayed. You had betrayed me. You told me that I would get better in life. You had only suckered me in. I was still the same as I had always been. Your philosophy had been the delusion. And the reason I stand before you tonight is because my higher power has had other plans for me. It was the women that came around me and held me up. I was so devastated that all the walls came down. I didn't even know there was walls between your knees. But you see, I got sober in toast burner country. I don't know if you know what that means, but I never burned toast. I didn't even know what toast was. These toast burner ladies came around and shared the secrets of their heart with me, and I was finally able to share the secrets of my heart with them. And I realized we were not so different. Maybe you drank in your bedroom and in your kitchen, and maybe the only man you'd ever been to bed with was your husband. But you felt just as dirty as I did when I would come home and not remember who I had been with the night before, and I drank in bars, and I was unprotected, and lived in a dirty bedroom in Mira Loma. And so it's from the women that have treated me like a woman, that I've learned to be a woman. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we learned to be each other's mamas. I never had a mama. My mother died, and we were always never able to communicate. I don't know why, but that was the way it was. I couldn't understand. We were like, she was like from the earth people and I was like from Mars. My mother and I never understood each other, you see. And even because I was sober, she was glad I was sober, but she didn't think I was alcoholic. To the day she died, they tried to push booze at me when I'd go over there. And, but here we learn to be each other's mamas. I've been mothered to the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. You've listened to me cry and you've listened to me whine. And sometimes I listen to you cry and I listen to your whine. And when I whine good. And I wear out this bunch and then I go to another bunch. And it is from the men in Alcoholics Anonymous that have treated me like a lady, that I've learned to be a lady. I went to one of you named Dave and I said, Dave, what is wrong with me? That I cannot seem to form a one-to-one relationship, not even with a beautiful man like Bruce. And he held me close and said, you are a beautiful, warm, loving lady. And one day you will know the reason. And I believed him. I never believed when people said anything good about me. I always thought they don't know me. That's why they're saying those things. But I believed him. And I went home and got on my knees and I thanked God for showing me the reason. And I said, okay, God, I know the reason. I'll bring him back. And he didn't come back. And I said, screw him all. Let him do what the goddamn please. I'm tired. I don't know about you guys, but for me that means surrender in the only language I understand. I said, I made peace with my higher power. I said, okay, God, I'm never going to be happy again. All you ever want me to do is work with the sick women drunks and let them puke on me. All right, all right. I don't know about your higher power, but mine has a weird sense of humor. When I want something so bad, okay, God, 10 Hail Marys, 10 Our Fathers, go to Mass and Communion every weekend, they don't come. As soon as you say, ah, screw it, here it comes. Now, I'm not here to tell you that young man came back because he went on to another life. But when I got to the other side, and you know there's another side to be gone through, that was the side where you think you want to put a shotgun, I want to put a shotgun about 2 inches from his belly, pull the trigger and watch all the gore flow over me. Or running down in the freeway with my car back and forth to his flat like a tortilla, you know, it's just, my sponsor assures me they don't lock you up for being crazy, only for acting crazy. And she also assures me that if God removes all my character defects, I'll disappear. So, when I got to the other side, I touched a power and a strength that was way down inside of me. And I knew that nothing and nobody could ever own me again. I found out that after all that's said and done, there's only you and me, God, anyway. All I ever wanted from them people that ate deep down inside of me, they never had it to give. You see, the only one that fills up all them empty places is my higher power. It promises me in page 63 of the top paragraph that he will take care of my needs if I perform his work well. Now, I don't know what God's work is. I do know that it says that my main purpose in life, not only in sobriety, is to fit myself to be a maximum service to God and the people about me. And I have somehow figured out that if I be gentle and kind, courteous and polite to you, and not by fitting myself, meaning I don't operate on my feelings of getting even. I never wanted to get even. I wanted one better. You know, one better. See, but if I don't act on that, I'm fitting myself in. I started working with the women. I didn't care what happened to them. I just did it because I'm supposed to do it. But God throws in the joker. I act as if I care, and one day I start caring. Where'd that come from? That wasn't my motive. I was just going to trudge and let them puke on me, and here I'm caring. What happens to them? You see, God throws in the joker. What I also found out that these steps don't care who takes them and who works them. These steps work for anybody, any jackass that does them. See, they don't care, you see. My children came back, they went to school, to work, I went to school, became self-supporting through my own contributions, continue to fall in love, and get married every weekend, I felt like it. I'm one of those ladies that had to learn to live alone to find out the difference between having solitude and being lonely. I'm one of those ladies that live alone long enough to say, What was I always afraid of living alone for? Jesus Christ, isn't that wonderful? I kept falling in love, and one day at a time I don't drink because I'm an alcoholic. One day at a time I don't steal because my sponsor won't let me. One day at a time I don't get married because there isn't any life after marriage, and so I started saving my money for my old age. And life got good. I found out that life does not get good by putting off till tomorrow. You see, I found out that happiness comes by being grateful for what I got. And I thank God I don't get what I deserve. Thank God I got mercy here. You know, God, the grace of God. I heard a song, and certainly you Protestants have heard about Catholics. We don't hear Protestant songs. But I was driving down the street one day, and I heard the song Amazing Grace. And I had to pull off of the side of the road. I thought I had discovered it. And you know how we do. Jesus, what a disappointment. That's when I found out everybody else had discovered it before me. My sister also, who had always been held as an example for me, started drinking and taking pills. And I tried to 12-step her, and she never thought she was as bad as me. And she chose to take her life, and it was my destiny to be the one to find her. And I could not believe what was before my eyes. I wanted to explode. But I called you, and you came. And something came together inside of me that said, God is the only giver and the only taker of life, and she chose to go home. And he let her go home. How many times did I want to die? And I could never die. And I didn't even want to die anymore. I didn't know when it was gone. And because his hand is always light whenever it is heavy, 2 weeks later, I became a grandma. I never knew how to be a mother, but I'm good as a grandma. I can hold myself up to any grandma. I got two granddaughters that found out that they think grandma and Santa Claus means the same thing. From the beginning, I found out I found out how to get along with kids, guys. Just give them everything they want. Huh? They just think I'm the greatest thing there is. You know, when they were still little, now they want things like cars. But when they were little, they come home one day, and the oldest one, I always been on a diet, and I was making milk with powdered milk, and her eyes got real big, and she said, Mama, Grandma, I just made milk out of water. I'll tell you what you thought I'm doing. Your children are the people God sends you just so you can have grandkids, huh? And the reason that grandparents and grandchildren get along so well is because we have a common enemy. And newcomer, I don't come to save you. I don't come to teach you. I don't come to give you nothing. Like if I saved anybody, it would have been my sister. I realize that I only come to you by divine appointment because I am God's melody of life, and he sings his song through me. I am a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I belong here. I took my oldest granddaughter to a conference with me once, and Ramona was one of the speakers, and she took care of my granddaughter. And I was dressing up, you know, how you do it. I put a big white blouse on that covers a multitude of tortillas and beans and white pants on, and she looked up at me with them shiny little eyes and said, Grandma, you look just like the white angel. And I looked at this child, and there was a sparkle in her eye, innocence in her face. And she saw what you've done with me, you see. She's never had to see the monster that her mother saw. You see, she's seen what you've done with me. And I could never have done it on my own. I have two daughters, you see. And my oldest daughter celebrated 10 years last May. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful to be friends with your children. We talk about everything, including sex. And my youngest daughter put needles in her arms. And there was some of you that have heard me talk before know that my daughter, there was years that I didn't know where she was at. I thought I'd open up the paper and see her, where she'd been killed or something. But my daughter called out for help one day. I realized that her life was none of my business. I don't know anything about release. anything I ever let go of, my sponsor sent me a t-shirt that says, anything I ever let go of has claw marks all over it. And my love is deadly. I can kill him with my love. So I realized that her life was none of my business, and my life was none of my business. And my those that I care for a lot's life is none of my business. It's God's business. And God has given me everything. On March the 29th, my youngest daughter celebrated 3 years as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is... I have it all. I have it all. You see, I am so grateful. I have my health. I have a man that loves me. People want to be with me. My children and I are friends. We don't fight. We love. That we are all so damaged, and we know that we did the best we could. If you were ever a dirty old person like I was, living in a bedroom in Mira Loma, there's no road that leads from there to here. When I drank, and my body was drunk, and my mind was in agony. And today I walk in the sunlight of the Spirit, and I belong to you, to my higher power. Thank you so much.